Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, man?
I'm okay. How are you?
Doing well. Feeling good. Going away this weekend.
Where are you going?
To Syracuse University, going back with the entire family.
Ah.
My mom, dad, sister, her boyfriend, Amanda, my wife, and Jack. His first trip up there. It's going
to
be great.
Back to see the old Orange men, huh?
Yep, we're going to go to a game at the Dome.
Nice. Coach Oldman will be there.
Coach Oldman will be there, and his son plays for the team. He's
wow.
a freshman.
It's exciting.
Player young man. And it should be fun. I'm really, really excited about it. The only problem is... Amanda has the flu. I'm a marvel of modern science, quite frankly, that I don't get sick more than I do. I should be studied.
Yeah, you don't get. You've got a young kid.
Yeah,
you don't get sick that much at all.
I know.
I mean, you are low risk as a person, though. You know, you don't put your
why.
I don't know. You don't
like you just said. I have a young kid who's not only do I have a 3-year-old, he's in daycare five days a week. Do you know, he's a walking petri dish.
But going out and staying up late allows the body to be run down enough to get a lot of colds.
What time do you think I go to bed at night?
Oh, between 10:30 and 11:30?
Usually later. Usually after midnight.
Wild man. By the way, you never asked me about my weekend. I was in Vermont.
Okay, how do you know I wasn't getting to it?
You weren't, were you?
What a show we have coming up. No, I am curious because I know you're, what are you, you people like to ski, but something.
Yeah, they all like to ski. I had a glorious Saturday where they all left the house that we rented, mm-hmm. Mount Snow, beautiful area. And I went out in God's country, that's what I call it. It's so wonderful. You see the mountains and I'm in a backyard, which is basically a massive field with a hill. And I just sledded. I created my own sled run. All on my own, watched all the football.
The Super Bowl?
No.
Soccer, you mean?
Yeah, I watched the Super Bowl on Sunday. This was Saturday. I had the whole day to myself while they were on a crowded mountain. Just, it was glorious.
Well, that sounds great. I always enjoy those.
I like me time more than anything in the world.
Me time means everything.
I want to be alone, Andrew.
You are a loner. I've always said that about you. What a show we have coming up. Lots to talk about in the Premier League from both over the weekend and midweek action as Manchester City and Everton have kind of just sort of wrapped up their afternoon fixture.
No, full time has happened. Stop talking like there's...
Only just. Here we are, pitch side. Players are heading back into the tunnel as we speak. And we got a what to watch for that I'm kind of on. And so it should be kind of fun. I hope all of you mildly enjoy it. We also have another podcast out.
Which is much more fun. That's all the excitement.
Well, John Strong joined us to kind of recap what we should and should not take away from the January camp with the U.S. men. We also talk about some of the movement in MLS and what it means for the league. And also there was a good red card and man of the match on that one. So there's just so much fun to be had, so much content to consume. Let's start with the content, and we'll do that with the EPL title race because it is on. It is on, JJ, it is on. Manchester City defeat Everton today, 2-0 is your final there, getting goals from Emerick Laporte and then Gabriel Jesus deep into stoppage time. And City jump over Liverpool.
On goal difference.
With a game at hand on goal difference. It's all to play for. I think we knew that this was going to be the case once Liverpool did move back in front of Manchester City. There have been a couple moments where we've looked at Liverpool and we've thought, okay, they could potentially give themselves some real breathing room and maybe end this thing. But they have been unable to take advantage of that.
It was never going to be a case.
It was always very on the knife's edge.
It was never a case of ending this thing, and I tried to dissuade people from talking that way, particularly you. Yeah, let's deal with City Everton first. Get it out of the way.
Yeah.
Marco Silva dropped some players. Rickarlison, Sigurdsson, Seamus Coleman, gave Tom Davies the captaincy. And Everton were good for spells of the game. But that old failing that if it'll let you down against Millwall in the cup, it's going to let you down again against a much better team and much more expensively assembled side. Now, Laporte's header was brilliant and it was an excellent delivery. But again, you have two Everton central players who are supposed to be defending a set piece looking at each other, wondering who was supposed to pick up. I mean, he literally just ran forward, took two steps back, out-jumped them all, leapt like a salmon into the back of the net. And that's right before halftime. So Everton are chasing the game in the second half. There was a few substitutions made. Richarlison came into it. Senik Tosun came into it. Theo Walcott was replaced, as was Bernard, who started the game and I thought had a good game in general. And it was not enough. Everton created a couple of chances. Ederson was out off his line. And then right at the death, Gabriel hit Jesus. Actually, it was unlucky for Pickford that he didn't block it entirely. Spun up.
He kind of did.
He kind of did. Jesus, it just spun up and he was Johnny on the spot. And
wasn't a defender there in time to assist.
And look, Everton were good. They were decent. City were okay. A City benefited largely from a referee who was not willing to take his cards out. I mean, Fernandinho could have been sent off for persistent fouling. There was two yellows in there. Didn't happen. Maybe that would have changed things. I don't know. When you see Kevin De Bruyne come on late, Gabriel Jesus come on late, you just get an idea of the depth in this team. And it was fairly comfortable, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree. Manchester City, I don't want to go overboard in talking about them because we are not all that far removed from when they lost to Newcastle. But I thought today, like you said, it was pretty comfortable.
I think the response at the weekend against Arsenal was very good. Arsenal were okay for only a small spell of the game. City made a mistake in terms of somehow Raheem Sterling's picking up, I think, Koscielny or somebody of that. The marking wasn't great in the set piece. But otherwise, you felt City were back to close to what they were beforehand.
Well, these goals that they're scoring. So Sergio Aguero scored a hat-trick, and I believe his three goals were from a combined 12 yards out.
Yeah, well, we saw what Rory Smith defined as the Guardiola goal. If there was a trademark move for Pep Guardiola, it would be move, cut back, tap in. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what Aguero's hat-trick was. I would say Arsenal's inability to defend and their just shambolic nature at the back means that you kind of want to pull back from saying, oh, City are back. City are back. We know this for sure now. So
oftentimes on this podcast, we like to go to the kitchen on fire analogy.
Oh, it's my perfect one.
The kitchen's on fire. Oh, let me go, you know.
Refurbished. The living room is wonderful.
Right.
My, what a nice sofa you have.
Yeah.
This chaise longue is looking well. There's smoke coming from your kitchen. That's Arsenal.
Yeah. They go out in January and, like, we've been talking for weeks and weeks and weeks. You know, defense needs help. Central defense. They need some help. So, okay, let's go bring in Denis Suarez. Oh, okay. I'm not saying he's bad.
No, but
it's just not really what it seems like they needed.
But also they're operating within constraints. So I think maybe perhaps looking to sign Denis Suarez was affordable rather than what they need at the back.
Yeah, I suppose that could be. You know, you talk about the way Manchester City are scoring goals. Boy, it just seems like they really have the right, like the perfectly assembled squad for the way Pep wants to play with Sterling and Sané out on the wings and the speed that they have to get in behind defenders into the channels and, you know, their ability to play in a ball to Aguero, who obviously we know what kind of finisher he is. It just, I don't know, it seems like they could get rolling again.
Yeah, it's almost as if two people from the backroom staff of one of the great Barcelona teams took up a residence in Manchester 2 years early and built this squad through signings ready for that manager to come in. It's almost like that happened.
Yeah. And so like we said, they now do move ahead of Liverpool on goal differential. It's plus 48 for Manchester City, plus 41 for Liverpool. I don't know, it kind of, not to go like down this road where we talk about, you know, change this, change that, but sometimes it does bother me that, like, okay, Manchester City beat Burnley 5-0. Like, Burnley are terrible this year. Like, why should that? Like, I think I've now come down more on the side of, I think head-to-head goal differential should be more important than overall goal differential.
Okay.
Like Manchester City's great showing against Burnley. I don't like that, you know, something like that could be the difference between who wins this title.
All right. I'm not really thinking about that just yet, but I see your point. Down the line, you're right, it could become a real factor.
Liverpool, they struggle again on Monday. in a 1-1 draw against West Ham. And it probably could have been worse in that...
Oh, that's the second game in which they could easily have lost.
The goal that they scored, there's just no way around it. They were lucky to have been given it. It was clearly an offside.
It was a mile offside.
And it's about as offside as I've seen a player this season in a goal that was allowed.
The only thing I'll say for the linesman was it was a slightly unusual offside in the sense the linesman is usually looking across the line and the offside occurs further away from him. This was right under his nose.
It's why,
and he does a little bit of a circle. Yeah. Milner did a little turn.
But it's also why this comment from Jurgen Klopp just kind of bothered me.
I heard meanwhile that our goal was offside, and I'm pretty sure the ref knew that then in the second half as well, because then I don't know if we had a in 50-50 situation or 60-40. It was always free kick for the other team, so that was a bit hard. Made life not easier, but at the end, it was not a game which you will win high, obviously. And so if we can make it the last second a goal, then it's brilliant. But we didn't, and so it's a point, and I think it's a fair point, and that's all.
I get what he's saying.
He's right about what he's saying in terms of if a referee knows there's an egregious mistake being made against one team, that and it's his set of officials, their team's fault in doing that, it weighs on them. And they genuinely, it's a human reaction. Yeah. It's like if Deborah is the receptionist in the morning in our fictitious office at Caught Offside Towers. Mm-hmm. And you were just wrapped up in a phone call from your wife. And Deborah says, oh, hi, Andrew, good morning. And you walk by and you don't really acknowledge her properly. The next time you see Deborah, when you realize what you've done, Deborah, how are you? How's Billy? How's the kids? We're going to have a cookout at the weekend.
Of course, yeah.
You're going to overdo it.
Yeah, I understand the nature of a makeup call.
Right, exactly. And he carried that with him. But for Jurgen Klopp to mention it is stupid.
Well, that's the thing.
There was no incident. Liverpool. It's not like there was a Naby Keita when... If he had said it about the Leicester game where Naby Keita goes flying in and it should have been a penalty, fine. There wasn't that incident.
Right. Like, is there some rule in the managerial handbook that says you must criticize officiating after every match? You're right. Maybe there was some sort of makeup call sentiment in the second half.
But it wasn't.
But Jurgen, let's weigh the two here. All right. You were unjustly awarded a goal in a 1-1 game.
Right. And almost the winner.
Yes.
Divock Origi was offside.
Again, by a mile.
Don't mention it. But by the way, the pettiness got even worse on the West Ham side.
But like, I just think, like, this is maybe, like, if we're going to talk about officiating decisions gone wrong, maybe sit this one out, Jurgen. Like, this might be a match where we can kind of let it slide because, like I said, you were given a goal in a 1-1 draw. What was the rest of the league? What were Spurs fans and Man City fans, you know, thinking as they watched that goal be allowed to happen?
Pellegrini's riposte was to bring up a Dortmund v Malaga game from 2012 or 2013 when they were both at different clubs where an offside went Jurgen Klopp's way as well.
Yeah. God, these guys and their memories and their bitterness that they just hold on to. It's beautiful. I really respect
anyway, it wasn't an issue. There was no refereeing call in the second half that meant Liverpool didn't get all 3 points. If anything, my life stopped several times, particularly when Mark Noble volleyed that shot over the top, which could easily gone into the top corner. I had a sliding doors, just kind of freeze frame moment on the Declan Rice header. Uh-huh. If that goes in, I don't actually see Liverpool scoring because they were that poor.
Yeah. Yeah, you could be right. And JJ, how many times... This is broken record stuff. The way West Ham scored their goal. I've said it before, and I'll continue to say it every time I watch these things happen. Why don't those moves happen more often?
Why aren't there more thoughtful free kicks instead of floating it in or going back?
Blocked by the... Oh, that one goes into row Z, as you like to
say.
Like that. Like, just try that at least once a match from some of these positions. And, like, at least... like I'm not saying you always score, but at least typically you get a shot on target, something maybe... some weird deflection in front of net. I don't know.
Honestly, Andrew, it was the run was the intelligent part of it, but the actual execution was so simplistic. And worse was Klopp saying afterwards, yes, we knew about that free kick that they do. Aye. And then you see Naby Keita not like Naby Keita has to be alive to that. He's got to be ready to go if you've seen this before.
Yeah.
That's another thing. That midfield of, when I saw it, I was like, Henderson and Wijnaldum were... Henderson had a late injury and Wijnaldum couldn't play. And you see Lallana, who has hardly played in the last 12 months. Naby Keita, who's been just has not settled at the club. Mm-hmm. And Fabinho in that midfield, that's a midfield that probably hasn't played together even in training. It didn't fill you with joy. And then you've got Matip at the back, and you've got a makeshift fullback. So you're taking James Milner out of the midfield where he can be win tackles and give you bite. And it's just the balance of that seven behind the front three is just not good.
I don't know. Something, you've been saying this for a while, and you're right. Something just, like, it's weird. Like, they're tied atop the league, but something just seems a little bit off right now.
Yeah, it really is. And you look at it, you've got Bournemouth coming up. Bournemouth, who are a good side, at least you can say you have them at Anfield. But you get the 3 points there, and then you're heading into what could be, you know, a monster tie against Manchester United at the end of the month, and you don't feel half the confidence you did previously. But honestly, even against United at home, Andrew, Liverpool didn't play that well. They were much better than United, but not that good. And look at the strokes of luck that we got against Everton. That was huge. Absolutely huge.
Oh my God. To think of what that game could mean at the end of the season. And to think of what it did, like where Everton's season went from that moment on.
I think the injuries have really hurt the team at the back. Mm-hmm. They've had like this kind of butterfly effect that's bled into the midfield. I think we are just not as deep as we thought we were. Think about this. Right at the end, you're looking to bring on Divock Origi or Daniel Sturridge. Those were your two front options to bring into this team. These are guys that during the summer we were probably thinking we'd never see again.
Well, yeah, but when you have a front line of Salah, Mane, Firmino, like also having Sturridge and Origi, it's not that bad. Let's not make it sound like they're hurting for options up front.
No, but look at it. Look, there's three guys, Lallana featuring in this game as well. Another guy we thought would be going out the door over the summer. It's...
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, look, these are...
Gabriel Jesus and Kevin De Bruyne coming on for City. That is the difference.
Yeah, you're right. And there are some people that have been intimating that maybe the nerves are getting the best of Liverpool.
I don't believe that. I just think they're playing poorly and have been for some time.
Well, Andy Robertson of Liverpool weighed in on that very subject.
I wouldn't say nerves are showing. Did anyone say that when, you know, City picked up no points at Palace and Leicester? I don't think they did. So it's no different for us. A lot of people talk about pressure because we've not been in this position, but it's February. I think everyone needs to relax and, you know, try and, you know, enjoy the run. And if you're fans or, you know, if you're a spectator from another club or whatever, then, you know, you can watch. You know, I'm sure many other teams would want to be in the position that we're in just now. So nerves aren't shown in the changing room. It's just, you know, it's been two poor results and poor performances. It happens during a long season. You know, we look back on it, we might look back on it as a good point, but we don't know that just now, and we need to get back to playing the better football that we can. But it's nothing to do with nerves.
I would tend to agree with him. Yeah. And even though it almost comes off sounding like trash talk, the way he started out by saying, well, were people saying that City were suffering from nerves when they didn't get results at whatever? Like, he's right. I think that's actually kind of the right thing to say.
Yeah, and when Firmino, who had just a dreadful game, gave away three balls in a row in attacking positions for Liverpool with about, we'll say, 75 minutes gone, crucial moment where you're trying to get that winner, like, that had nothing to do with nerves. If anything, it was the opposite of nerves. He was too complacent.
Yeah. Liverpool, I mean, we can talk about nerves. They've lost one game this season.
Yeah.
All right, Manchester City have lost four. Now,
right.
Because of, you know, Liverpool have five draws to City's two.
And Sir Alex Ferguson said what? Sir Alex Ferguson kind of came up with the fact you can't afford to lose more than three games. Three was the magic number.
Well, that may not bear itself out.
No, City last season created a new dynamic where they said, well, you can't even lose three now. Two is all they lost last season. Now they've lost twice that. Four. They've gone over the Fergie rule. They've gone over the same rule they set last season. And yet we're not counting them out at all. They're top.
Continuing on, JJ, if that's what it takes, if that's the number of losses it takes to win a title, what about draws? Because Tottenham are determined for that number to be zero.
Six defeats. It's funny, though. You can look back at some of those games, and those defeats for Tottenham, they could easily have been draws. Easily have been draws.
And some of their recent wins, like this most, their last three, almost their last three matches, right? Fulham.
They haven't drawn once this season.
No, and it goes back to April of last season. They have now broken the record. With 29 consecutive either wins or losses, non-draws, which is, I don't really know what that means. It's funny because Tottenham,
I think it's,
a few years ago was that team where, like, remember they were unbeaten deep into the season, but it was because they had so many draws. Yeah. And they were still like fourth in the table. And now they've gone the complete other direction. The big takeaway here, I guess, you know, they were in the title race, then they were laughed at because they were in the title race and then lost to Arsenal, and they were out of the title race, and now they're 5 points back, and people are saying they're back in. The collective footballing world is having a very hard time deciding whether or not Spurs are part of this title race. And what I would say to those people is it's a two-pronged answer. Yes, they are part of the title race, and no, they're probably not going to win it. Both things can be true.
Yeah.
Like, you can be a part of a title race and at the same time believe that, you know, people can believe that you're not going to come out winners.
But people aren't that nuanced anymore. They're just not. There's no long view. There's no broad view. There's no plus or minus. There's only one hot take, one thing. Spurs are bottlers. They're not in the race. Ha, ha, ha. That's it.
Yeah.
Nobody really watches the games anymore. Nobody pays attention to anything.
You think Tottenham are happy that South Korea got knocked out when they did by Qatar in the Asian Cup? Because Son has come back, and he has just been absolutely outstanding for them. He scored a huge equalizer, which ended up they ended up winning the game. And then in this one, he scores the winner against Newcastle. And
although,
it wasn't great goalkeeping.
But it was a brilliant, sharp turn and shot.
After Llorente laid it off to him. Even Llorente, I'm having a hard time criticizing. And you know that's one of my hobbies, JJ.
You listed on your resume as one of your hobbies.
Yeah. I came across an interesting stat here about Tottenham's place among the top six. This was after the January transfer window closed, and they showed the list of the top six clubs since the summer of 2014 and how they rank in terms of points over that time and how they rank in terms of net spend. JJ, Tottenham are second in terms of points over that span. But in terms of money that they've spent, they are, when I say they're last, it's almost humorous how much further behind they are than all these other clubs. Manchester City have spent the most at $745.5 million. Manchester City have spent almost $1 billion since 2014 on their club.
Mm-hmm.
Tottenham have spent $64 million. Manchester City have spent almost $700 million more than what Spurs have. And yet Tottenham are right behind them in terms of points over that time.
You do realize that the Manchester City player wage bill is almost twice what Spurs is.
Oh, yeah.
It's over 100 million more.
Well, Daniel Story, he tweeted this. According to UEFA's report, Tottenham's wage bill is 148 million euros. So you could double the wages of every single Tottenham player. They could sign 7 new players on 100 grand a week, and they would still have a lower wage bill than Manchester City.
See, people, I guess, because, you know, they support City and they, you know, there's that tribal thing in football. I must defend my club regardless of the information or who's running it. But, like, that is such a distorting thing to have to fight against.
And it's why I just simply can't listen to people who want to criticize Mauricio Pochettino. Because the fact that he's doing what he's doing in a league where money seems to be everything, he is bucking every trend. Financially, it's incredible.
I hate the way we talk about money so much in the Premier League.
I know. One last thing, though. If you want to talk about really bad value for money, in that stat of since 2014, Manchester United and Arsenal are tied for fifth among the top six. They both have 331 points over that time. But United have spent almost $700 million. That's really bad, man.
So Ole Gunnar Solskjaer knows how to drive a Ferrari is all we know.
Yeah, I suppose we're seeing that. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very quick break, come back. Copa del Rey had the first leg of the semifinal today. I almost said the El Clasico.
The El Clasico.
But I say it as a joke sometimes, but I really almost said it.
It didn't
there.
Feel like an El Clasico.
Well, because Messi, well, he didn't play. He didn't start.
He didn't start. And it was on a Wednesday in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Bit weird.
Yeah, I suppose. Lots more to get to. Some feisty tempers, JJ, between two ESPN employees when talking about Maurizio Sarri and Chelsea. I have the audio. I'm curious. I don't know if you've heard this yet.
Oh, I think I have. Oh, it's very good.
But it made me very uncomfortable. I hid in a corner while it was going on.
You hit even the audio of confrontation.
All of it. It all makes me uncomfortable. All that and more. Don't go anywhere. back now. Caught offside. Did you Copa del Rey, first leg, semifinal, El Clasico, Barcelona, Real Madrid. Earlier today, 1-1 is your final. Real Madrid scoring early, sixth minute. I believe it was Lucas Vazquez scoring. And then in the second half, Malcolm, who has kind of been maligned since coming to Barcelona, scored a goal where Luis Suarez hits the post. It completely like deflects across goal.
By the way, can we talk about the Luis Suarez effort and the angle that was from?
Yeah.
That's going in.
Well, it hit the post.
It not cleared off the line, though?
I thought it hit the post and then deflected across the 18-yard box where Malcolm was by himself. And he settled it and finished nicely. And 1-1 is how this one ended.
Dermot Corrigan tweeted this. Looking at the replay of Malcolm's goal, Ramos throws his hands to his face as the ball hits the net. Looks like he could have got there, but didn't move as thought it was going wide. I thought it was a brilliant finish from Malcolm.
Yeah.
It really was. Also, I love this by... this is from Solari, the Real Madrid manager, talking about Lucas Vazquez. Lucas Vazquez has some of the virtues which I value most in the Spanish character. He has solidarity and bravery. I love the way foreign managers talk about their players sometimes. It's very
describing him as being brave?
No, it's very different. It's much more effusive. You know, the English patter seems a bit different, doesn't it?
I'm trying to think if they talk.
Apart from Brendan and tremendous character.
You know, well, what do you mean? They're very like, dramatic?
This feels different. It's like he's talking about a great Spanish general or a fantastic public servant.
Yeah, I suppose I could see that.
The virtues which I value most in the Spanish character. Like, could you imagine somebody talking about Jamie Vardy in those terms? Oh, he's a fantastic son of Albion. You know? He embodies the rich spirit of the English Midlands. You just wouldn't hear it.
No, you're probably right. In terms of this game, I would say that this was important for Real Madrid, going on the road to Barcelona and coming away with that away goal as they prepare for the second leg back at the Bernabeu. In a season where it looks like Real Madrid are not going to catch Barcelona...
This may provide a quantum of solace.
Were we talking about James Bond or?
I really like that phrase.
Oh, okay.
And I just like to shoehorn it into conversations.
So you did, very gracefully too.
It works.
Yeah. Like I said, Leo Messi was not able to start this match after he picked up an injury over the weekend. And like I said, credit to Malcolm, who hasn't really had a place on this team. It was supposed to be a pretty good signing. Now, he is young. He's still, 21 years old? So it's going to be hard for him to break in. And it was pretty ambitious of him to, I guess, want to go to Barcelona in the first place. But when they come calling and you're that age, it's hard to say no. And the chances have been few and far between. But with Messi not having his chance, not being able to start this one, I think this is important for Malcolm to get that goal.
Yeah, there was a lot of criticism early on in his Barcelona career. Talk about him even being sold on again.
Yeah,
very quickly. So, it was, and it was a pretty good finish too.
Yeah. Let's see. Also, yesterday, JJ, Werder Bremen and Borussia Dortmund played out a classic in the German Cup. It was 3-3, and then Werder Bremen did go on to win in penalties. But none of that really matters because
it's time for Boy Wonder Watch, Christian Pulisic. Oh, that boy really is special!
Because, JJ, when the boy wonder comes on in a game of importance and does this, well, then the result hardly even matters.
Now Pulisic bursting forward. Alcacer. This Pulisic is Christian Pulisic! And out in Berlin. Dortmund break. And Dortmund score.
Super goal. He's bursting through the center.
Yeah.
It was his own initiative that started the move, the 1-2, and then the beautiful finish. His first goal since October.
Yeah, I feel like he...
needed that.
And we, all of us together, collectively, we needed that.
Because all we had really was a lot of transfer talk about him going to Chelsea.
Yeah, I know.
And not much action to talk about. And well, that just, was good.
There's just been so much uncertainty with him. And that's just a thing that we have not, of all the things that we've talked about with him over the last 2 years, uncertainty has not been one of them. He's, you know, he's been playing in Champions League fixtures and he's been, you know, a lockdown first team starter. And we were told by Stepan Butsko, who covers Borussia Dortmund for ESPN, that, oh, don't worry, Pulisic, he's fine here, don't worry about
Stefan's
it.
Stefan's great, but he didn't see it coming.
No. So there's been a lot of uncertainty with Pulisic. He's been passed by Jadon Sancho. So I think that this was, again, they lost, but he scored that goal in extra time.
Super goal.
Yeah, and it was a very important goal. So I don't know, hopefully, maybe that kind of gets him back in Lucien Favre's rotation in at least some way, because we do want him to continue, even though he's not a Borussia Dortmund player really going forward after the season, but we would like him to keep playing there for now just to continue to improve and progress as he has. Like we always say, these guys have to play. They have to play. We never thought that would be a concern for him, but it has been of late. So I was very, very happy to see that happen. JJ, what to watch for? We mentioned one Copa del Rey semifinal first leg that took place today. There's another one tomorrow at 3:00, Real Betis and Valencia. EPL Saturday, 7:30 a.m. I wrote p.m. on here, but that would be weird. Fulham and Manchester United. And they're all important for Fulham now, and they're kind of important for Manchester United as well, as this battle for the top four is shaping up to be a very, very interesting one.
Why does that feel like that could be wildly entertaining? Fulham are going to have to attack. There's a gung-ho attitude about some of the players that they have. United, obviously, will be away from home. That means they'll sit back just that little bit and then they'll spring that counter with the fast wide players that they have. I don't know. This could be a good one.
I know. And especially with the era of good feelings continuing after their 1-0 victory over the weekend.
You said it, friend.
That goal, though, Paul Pogba's ball to Rashford, just perfectly chipped, perfectly weighted over the top.
Brilliant goal.
And Rashford's first touch, which is something that I'm seeing more and more with him, I think.
He's his awareness of where he is in terms of the goal is very good, too. His first touch is good. He could turn out to be a gem of a striker. Like, people were so quick to criticise him when things were going bad under Mourinho and he was playing out of position. A chance would emerge for him and he'd miss it. And people would get on his back so quickly. That's all changed now. I will say this, though. Leicester were well capable of getting a point in that game and probably should have had one. There was a couple of moments. A Johnny Evans header from a corner. It's almost like he didn't want to score against United.
Against his old team. Mm. Talking about Rashford's first touch, this is a broad soccer question.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you think. I'm starting to feel like when I see a player, like what is the greatest indicator in this sport of how talented a player is?
First touch.
And I feel like the more I watch soccer, the more that I think it's that.
Even in my brief shot at playing professional football or semi-professional football, when it's like Rovers opened up their trials when I was like 17 or 18. Because it's cheaper to bring in local junior soccer players. So I went in and I spent about a month with them. I could do a lot of things. I could strike the ball decently. I could run. I was fit and I was fast. My first touch, compared to some of the guys who were playing in the league a long time or some of the guys who'd been bought from Scotland and England, it was glaring.
Yeah,
their first touch would take them away from the defender, would take them into space. And it was instant, and mine was not.
Yeah, see, it's sad that you say that, because I was playing in my house with Jack the other day. We were kicking a ball around. You should have seen my first touch. Left him in my dust. It was pretty pathetic, quite frankly. Let's see, Saturday, 10 a.m., Crystal Palace and West Ham. I wanted to follow up on something we talked about last week with Wilfried Zaha, after he was shown a second yellow for sarcastically clapping at an official. I was reading Paul Doyle. He had a story in The Guardian last week about Zaha, and he pointed out some things that actually we mentioned months ago on this podcast, but I felt that it kind of bears repeating now, given Zaha being in the news for the same reason. He carries this label with him as a serial diver, and it's just not true. Now, Doyle points out here, JJ, that in the last four seasons, Wilfried Zaha has been fouled 387 times. Only Eden Hazard's been fouled more in that time. And by the way, number three on the list is Alexis Sanchez, who's been fouled more than 100 fewer times than Zaha. So no one's even really remotely close to Hazard and Zaha. Now, Watford fans have always had this disdain for Zaha in particular, and it stems back to 2013 when he won a penalty against them in the championship playoff. They, like many other fan bases, believe that he is a chronic diver. Remember the stuff with the Hornet? And like Roy Hodgson got all like hot and bothered about like Harry the Hornet making fun of Wilfried Zaha for being a diver. So Watford fans have always had this belief that he's a diver, which is nonsense, like I said, especially when you hear things like this from Watford's very own Troy Deeney. He said this to BBC Radio's 5 Live about their strategy, Watford's strategy in dealing with Zaha. Deeney, you take it in turns kicking him. I know no one wants to hear that, but you go, you hit him this time. You hit him the next time. You don't have the same player tackle him because you know you're going to get booked. So are Watford fans done complaining about Zaha being a diver when one of your own players is saying that their actual strategy is to kick him about the pitch
when they
play them?
And by the way, that's classic strategy for a lot of teams, to identify a player that's going to really hurt you on the opposition and hit him early, get him ruffled.
Yeah.
But Zaha has, like, the stats are there on how many times he's tackled and fouled. And sometimes you're watching games and you're thinking, is it because he's quite physically imposing? That he is strong and tall. That referee,
and he's fast.
But that maybe referees don't call it as much as they should.
I don't get it. It's a perception that has existed about him, and it's a false one, and it's not fair. It's not fair. Saturday, 10 a.m., Liverpool and Bournemouth.
Well, hang on. We shouldn't just gloss over West Ham.
You know what? You're right.
West Ham and the Metropolitan Police investigating alleged Islamophobic abuse of Mo Salah from Monday night's game at West Ham. And there's a video circulating which most people have heard if they're a football fan online, and he's clearly being abused by a West Ham fan. And kick it out. This is from Jacob Steinberg's Twitter, he of The Guardian. Kick it out statement. We are dismayed to see yet another high profile incident of discrimination in English football. This time a video of disgraceful anti-Muslim abuse aimed at Liverpool's Mohamed Salah. So, and by the way, Jacob Steinberg,
he was very nearly my man of the match this week on the podcast.
He's a West Ham fan, and he's unashamed about that. He often mentions it. Mm-hmm. He's an excellent writer, too.
Yeah.
And he spoke out, first of all, about what was clearly a problem with West Ham fans and Spurs fans and anti-Semitism. That was yesterday. And today he's highlighted this problem with Mohamed Salah and is getting absolutely vile abuse on Twitter from his alleged own fans, West Ham fans.
He's taking them on directly, and I think the hope was that other, and look, I'm not going to speak for all West Ham fans, because if I had to guess, I would say the vast majority of them are probably like Jacob Steinberg and horrified by this behavior. But I saw the tweets that he was replying to, and I think the hope, for me at least, was that you would see a lot of West Ham fans kind of cheering him on in this crusade to kind of remove this element from West Ham. And what you saw was the exact opposite of that. And it was West Ham fans really laying into him and basically referring to him as a Spurs fan in disguise.
Yes, because he is Jewish.
Right.
Again, this whole kind of association, Spurs, Jew, just...
In its derogatory connotation, which is just wrong. It's just so wrong.
And by the way, the idea that there isn't a huge contingent of Jewish fans in London who support West Ham is just like, there's an element crept back in. I know we had a piece from Millwall last week from 1977. Where a Millwall hooligan said, we'll never change, Chelsea will never change, West Ham fans will never change, we'll always be like this. And you begin to wonder, you know, has that element which we think was gone re-emerged in English football?
Yeah, I feel like there's this inborn thought in some of these fans' minds that this is like you're playing a role. Like, if you're going to support West Ham, this is the way you need to be. Like, it's almost some sort of nostalgic element back to, like, the good old days. And it's just, like, it's such warped thinking. Like, no, this is what was wrong with the old days. Like,
yeah.
And some people just have a hard time seeing it that way. And, yeah, good for Jacob Steinberg to take on his own fan base, despite the fact that they are really, really letting him hear it. And, yeah, hopefully he can at least change some minds, because it's pretty ugly. So props to him. Saturday, 10 a.m., Liverpool and Bournemouth. You said before, JJ, that why does Fulham-Manchester United feel like a match that could be really fun? That Liverpool-Bournemouth would probably be my candidate this week for that sort of game.
Yeah. Bournemouth, as we've talked about in the last few weeks. Now, I don't expect Liverpool to be as shambolic as Chelsea were, but Bournemouth have some players and some really exciting young players, and a Liverpool team that's a little bit nervy and is going to dominate the ball, we would expect. Bournemouth are going to be dangerous on the break. And this is another game in a fraught little period for Liverpool that is trickier.
It definitely is. Now, fortunately for them, it is at home, which helps. And also fortunate for them, Bournemouth are coming off a 2-0. I feel like, JJ, that we have sort of a caught-offside curse or a caught-offside jinx going here, and it works both ways. Like, for example, I destroyed Moussa Sissoko, and then what happened? All of a sudden, like a week after that, he began this brilliant run of play.
Right.
What happened last week? For the first time maybe ever on this podcast, we mentioned how good David Brooks is. Then what happened? He got hurt, and he's out for a month.
Right.
So that potentially be helpful for Liverpool.
It's very helpful, but if you look at, like, say, someone like Fraser, King, I mean, even up front for Bournemouth, they've got old boy Solanke. What a story that would be.
Is that what you call him?
Yeah.
It's a good nickname.
Well, I should really say Liverpool old boy. He's not an old boy.
No, hardly.
No. I'm making him sound like a treasured family
He's
dog.
He's, like, really young, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, you know what? I don't care for that nickname, to be honest. Sunday, 8:30 a.m., Tottenham and Leicester City. Did you see, I'll tell you, you know how much I love the NFL, and the Super Bowl was this past Sunday, and it just hurts my heart every time I see Harry Kane trot out there in a Tom Brady jersey. Like, the only, at least the one thing I'll say is he's not bandwagon. Like, I've seen
interviews. No, he's been into it for a long time.
Forever. Like, before the NFL was, like, cool.
Before he was cool.
Right. Like, he has been an obsessive American football fan for a long time. So I'll give him his respect. His team won. And he was there to witness it, and he met all the players, it looked like, afterwards.
And he was doing his rehab on the trip as well, yeah, which is important.
But, like, it's funny because, like, a lot of players for the Patriots, you sometimes wonder how aware are, like, American athletes of some of these stars over in England and Europe. They seem to be as, like, in awe of Kane as he is of them. Like, it seems like, I don't know, like, a lot of mutual respect going
on
there.
Who was the Patriots person, player that tweeted out how much he loved Harry Kane? He's my man. Who was that?
That's right. I don't remember now.
I
want
to say, was it Julian Edelman?
I can't remember.
I think it might have been Edelman.
Yeah. But the good news for Tottenham is that I believe I saw Dele Alli is starting to train again. So still probably a couple...
He was running today.
Probably still a couple weeks away. But that's good.
It's progress.
You certainly use it. Sunday, 11 a.m. This is probably the one you circle this weekend. Manchester City and Chelsea at the Etihad.
And I'll be cheering for Chelsea. Good Lord.
We forgot to mention before, Everton supporters today cheered, I was reading, at the final whistle. Did you hear that?
No.
Oh. Because Manchester City had gone back above Liverpool?
I did not hear that.
Okay.
Now, granted, I was in Manhattan watching it, so maybe a small pocket did. I also heard them when Jonjo Kenny flew into a tackle to win the ball, they were up for it. They wanted their team to win. I don't believe, as much as they
despise,
I don't believe that.
But it would have been so Everton to, like, finally, when they get that great win, it helps their, like, it directly helps their biggest rival.
I can imagine there was a few fellas in the pub making the joke after their second or third point, well, at least we didn't help Liverpool.
Right. We talked a lot about City before, so let's focus on the Chelsea side of this, which has been pretty interesting over the past couple of days. Eden Hazard has said that he has made his decision as to what he's going to do at the end of the year. And then that's all he said. If I were a betting man, which I'm not, but if I were, I would say he's gone.
Oh, he's gone. Well, I believe it to be the case.
Yeah.
And I think just all the elements of it, he's not getting on particularly well with the manager right now from what we understand. He doesn't like the
position. Not from what we understand, from everyone's words.
He doesn't like the position or what the manager may be trying to change him into almost like a Dries Mertens.
Right, like Hazard.
You've got the wrong Belgian.
But like all we heard for so much of this season, while Alvaro Morata was giving them nothing and Olivier Giroud was rooted to the bench, we kept seeing these stats about how Hazard does not score goals when Morata plays. But when Giroud does, he's got this incredible record of goal scoring. And so what does Sarri go out and do? I'm just going to never play Olivier Giroud. How's that going to make Eden Hazard feel?
Right, but he's also at a stage in his career where he's in big contract territory because he's 2 years shy of 30. This is the time to make that big move. I just feel it's all come together.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know Chelsea anything. He's been there 7 years.
No, he's won titles there, and he's been a player of the year there. Here's what Craig Burley said when he was talking about the subject of whether or not Sarri has essentially pushed Hazard out of Chelsea.
He's maybe thinking, well, I've got my gaffer coming out and talking about me every other week or every other day, saying I don't do this and I don't do that, and I'm an individual player and I'm not a captain and I'm not this, that and the next thing. So he probably thinks, well, who can play that game? So, listen, you couldn't deny, and I think it would be absolutely the right thing for him to do. Who can deny anybody going to one of the two big clubs in Spain? What an opportunity. Will he make a difference at Real Madrid? Of course he will. They absolutely need him. They need freshness in there. And I think he's just left it out there because I'm surmising that he's a bit miffed at some of the comments that Maurizio Sarri has made in the last few days about Chelsea, about the players and about him.
This guy dealt with years of Mourinho. Now he's got to deal with this. He probably thinks, you know what? Like, I can deal with this anywhere. I may as well go somewhere where I'm paid like extraordinarily well.
Yeah, it's never good when Hazard is the regular point of comment for a Chelsea manager, and it's not praise. You know, and it's happened early, by the way. This is February in their first season. He doesn't want this again.
Probably not. Probably not.
And now, there is enough uncertainty around the club that he'll be quite happy to see this as a natural end, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I don't know him, and like, but I'm just guessing.
And it will hurt. It will hurt Chelsea greatly, but I would think the fan base, like if he comes back there with Real Madrid, he's like, we're talking massive ovation, right? I mean, this guy's been a tremendous player.
Yeah, I wouldn't be sure about that.
Oh, really?
That's just because of who Chelsea fans are. Not so much anything else.
Direct your messages to @JJDevanny.
Yeah.
So now the conversation, I guess, continues and with more of a focus on Maurizio Sarri. So on ESPN FC the other day, they were talking about Gab Marcotti and Steve Nichol were talking about Maurizio Sarri. And it's funny, there's this kind of like inflection point as to whether or not Sarri has done a very good job so far for Chelsea or whether or not he's turning into a disaster, not just with performances on the field, but probably more so with comments that he's making and just like, you know, bringing so much of the whatever sort of backroom strife there is, just like thrusting it right out into the public.
Yeah. And you can only do that once. If you're looking for a reaction, a manager can only do that once, right? If he keeps doing that,
well, at that point,
the dressing room is numb to it.
Right. It's time to bring in new players.
Right.
Like that's just, it's just as simple as that. So Gab Marcotti was defensive of Sarri and what has gone on so far, and Steve Nichol was not. And here's some of their conversation.
Pep Guardiola finished fourth in his first season. You want to see something funny? Go look where Jurgen Klopp was when he'd had more time at the end of his first season at Liverpool. This always happens to people who do things differently. Sometimes they work. Sometimes it works, and then we applaud them. Sometimes it doesn't work, and then they lose their job. And that's what's going to happen to Sarri if he loses his job. But to go out and immediately dismiss him because he's different.
You want to throw Pep's name in? He didn't turn Man City into a circus. He took responsibility. He spoke sensibly. He never threw anybody under the bus. He didn't.
Yeah.
He didn't throw his coaching staff under the bus.
You can't get away with this spoke sensibly thing about Pep Guardiola, because remember when he came out and he said
every single thing Sarri's done in the last two weeks goes against everything that proper managers do. Mm. Hey, go back
proper
100
managers,
years.
Proper, you
go,
football men, proper managers.
Proper managers.
Proper football
correct.
Men. Yeah. Works great, doesn't it? Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, I agree with Gab to the extent that somebody comes into English football and does things a little bit differently, you're told to conform straight away. Pep didn't conform, although he did go out and spend $300 million on like fullbacks. Mm-hmm. But there is a certain, and Gab references it there, a proper football man, the guide, the way to do things, and he has veered off it. And he's kind of accusing Stevie Nicol of being that guy. I would say that Gab is the very man quoted on this podcast last week who said the following: the Sarri system works, or you look for a new manager. Meaning that Sarri plays this way. It's not changing. That suggests an inflexibility. Not so much that he's trying new things, rather that he's come in with the old thing and he can't change to anything new. But that's why he'll get the sack.
But the problem, I don't think, is even necessarily if everything was the same. Like, Chelsea right now are sitting fourth and they're preparing themselves to take part in the League Cup final. Like, if all of that was the same and Sarri was just behaving normally off the pitch, then I don't think we'd really be having this conversation. But you heard Steve Nicol there referencing the fact that Sarri is turning them into a circus. That's where the problem is. I think people would be understanding of Chelsea's situation. A new manager, he came in late, doesn't have his players, and yet look what happened. He just brought in Gonzalo Higuain. They win 5-0 over the weekend, and Higuain scores twice. People would be understanding of Chelsea and maybe even praise them after defeating Spurs over two legs to reach the League Cup final. But it's the fact that Sarri, like we just played Craig Burley talking about how this manager has come in and essentially pushed out arguably the best, not arguably, the best player on the team. I think that's the problem with this guy.
I don't understand why he's come out and said things like, I can't motivate this team. I can't understand why he's gone after Hazard so early and said, he doesn't do this, he doesn't do that, he can be a great player, but right now he's not at X level or what. I don't understand why an experienced manager would do that. I just don't. I agree with Gab to the point that you've got to let him take this to its logical end. If you're going to bring in Sarri and he wants to play a certain way, you've appointed a manager, you've got to let that happen. On the other hand, I don't understand how that works in tandem with this kind of aggressive behavior in the media towards his dressing room.
Yeah.
Can't figure it out.
I agree. And I think that's why ultimately I kind of I see both of their points. I really do. But I think I land more on Stevie's side of this just because, like, he is kind of turning them into a bit of a circus right now, especially, you know, the 4-0 defeat at Bournemouth and then to just tear into the club and not really take much responsibility yourself. I don't know. It just seemed like such a bad look to me.
Yeah. I can't motivate them. As if they're unmotivatable.
Yeah, and now they travel to Manchester City with City back in front atop the league. I don't know. It's going to be this race for top four is so interesting to me with Chelsea and Arsenal and these new managers, both of whom like fan bases already seem to be getting frustrated with. And then meanwhile, here comes Manchester United, who were back of the pack, and like Solskjaer comes in and it's re-energized everything.
I got to check in with Arsenal Fan TV. I have to for next week. Remind me.
Troops?
We need to see what Troops is saying about Emery.
Yeah.
He's got the goat blood.
Oh, it's fascinating. This should be a great weekend. A lot of these games are really compelling to me. Like we said, Liverpool, Bournemouth, Tottenham, Leicester, Man City, Chelsea, United, Fulham. Like, this is a really good weekend slate. But I'll be in Syracuse for all of it. So I'm
with your family as well.
Do some DVRing.
Andrew, why are you watching the soccer, man?
This is what you think. This is my family to you? How am I supposed to take that?
I just think that's what your mom is like. or your elderly aunt.
I won't be with aunts, but many cousins.
Yeah. Is that's a lot of family, though.
Yeah, it is.
Probably too much.
I would never say that. How dare you?
You've kind of intimated that to me off air. To anyone. Off air, you suggested it might be a bit heavy on family.
I'm excited because I'm going to go home now because I have a new show that I'm probably going to get made fun of by some people.
But don't say this is us. Don't say this is us.
No, but I do watch that. Oh. And it's an emotional roller coaster.
On this week's This Is Us.
No, you know what I've been watching? That I've been watching Project Blue Book. Do you know anything about this?
No.
It's on the History Channel.
Oh.
And it's based on true events. It takes place, I think, back in the 50s, shortly or late 40s, early 50s, after World War II. And it's about essentially UFO sightings.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And it's the lead role is played, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name, but it's the guy who plays Littlefinger, or played Littlefinger on Game of Thrones.
Oh, the Irish actor, Aidan Gillen.
Yeah, yeah. He's the main character in it. And
really?
I didn't think I was going to like it because, I don't know, UFOs, whatever. But like the fact that it's based on true events, now I think I'm four episodes in. I'm going to watch the fifth one on DVR tonight. And like after watching the first four, I end each week and I'm just like, so UFOs happened. Like, is anyone else watching this right now? If this show is based on true events, then you are telling me that life, extraterrestrial life, has visited this planet. It's simple. Why is this not like a bigger deal?
I can imagine you on a farm in the 1930s when they played Orson Welles' War of the Worlds.
Oh my God.
Across the radio.
Can you imagine?
And it broke in it starts with like a radio announcement, a fake radio announcement about an alien invasion. Can you imagine you? Amander!
Who am I?
Grab Jack! Get the dog! We gotta get out of here! There's the aliens coming!
I'm sure it was terrifying for all of these poor people.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if anybody else is watching, because I'd like to hear from you if you've had if people have had the same reaction to the show that I have, because I haven't really heard anything about it.
By the way, can I say one thing to people who are still emailing me and messaging me asking, have I seen They Shall Not Grow Old? I have. I saw it last week in the bitter cold. I went to the movies. It was playing in Brooklyn. To say it moved me is an understatement.
Oh, it's
beautiful.
Yeah. You'll never forget it.
It's horrifying and beautiful, but I won't forget it. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Really great.
Yeah. Totally agree. Hey, everybody, enjoy the coming weekend of matches. Should be a lot of fun. To you, I say...
Take you later, fun boy.
Take care.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.